That is the end of the consent agenda. Is that correct?
Correct.
All righty. First time certain item, please, 1110.
Proclaim October 2017 Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you. Are we going to read the second item with it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. And 1111.
Increase a grant agreement with the YWCA of Greater Portland in the amount of $30,000 to allow the YWCA to become a host agency for an Encore Fellow position at Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. This is a time for us to bring awareness to the countless people, victims and survivors, children and families, friends and communities that are impacted by domestic violence. Domestic violence is the ongoing pattern of abusive, manipulative, or controlling behavior where one partner maintains power and control over another partner. This typically happens in the form of physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. In the city of Portland, domestic violence accounts for a significant portion of all assaults. It is estimated that nearly 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men will be affected by domestic or sexual violence in their life. Nearly 3 women are killed every day by their intimate partners. Just in the past 4 weeks alone, we have lost 2 young women due to domestic violence. Shay Martinez, age 29, and Lila Streeter, age 26. Shay was assaulted by her boyfriend and died 2 days later from traumatic injuries. Lila was assaulted by her husband and later died from blunt force trauma to her head and abdomen. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of these 2 young women. The City of Portland and Multnomah County have a long-standing commitment to prevent and address and help to prevent domestic violence and help families heal from it and its impacts on our communities. We have invested in specialized police units, provided funding for community-based advocates, and we've partnered together to bring a variety of services and resources for families experiencing domestic violence under one roof at the Gateway Center. Through our joint support of the Gateway Center, we strive to prevent and reduce the impact of violence and its subsequent trauma by providing comprehensive advocacy and services in a welcoming and culturally sensitive environment. The Gateway Center was also the first place, other than the downtown courthouse, where people could go to obtain a temporary restraining order. Today, our satellite courtroom at the Gateway Center files over 50% of all restraining orders in Multnomah County. And we will soon expand to offer elders and people with disabilities protection orders against their abusers. The Gateway Center prioritizes survivors' safety, promotes survivors' rights, and supports survivors' desire to be free from violence and abuse. I am immensely proud of the work that is done every day at the Gateway Center. It is not easy work, and it takes dedicated individuals to make a difference in our community. And we have some of those dedicated individuals with us today to talk more about the work going on in our community to prevent, address, and help families heal from domestic violence. We will start off with the Gateway Center Director, Martha Strawn Morris. Then we have Abby Gassama. Naya? Okay, got that right. Tiffany Eggleton, a survivor and dedicated advocate. And I think we also have Chuck Sparks of the District Attorney's Office.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. He had to leave to chair a committee. Yes, I apologize.
Okay. I'll go ahead and I'll turn it over to Martha.
Thank you so much. I'm Martha Strawn Morris, the Director of the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services. And Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners, I really appreciate you taking the time to make this proclamation and acknowledge this month. I was desperately trying to get a web-based version of my presentation up so that you could see a video. I'm not sure if I did or not, and my charts might be a little bit funny, but you'll forgive me. The video, I feel like, is more important. In the 8 years that I've been working exclusively in the domestic violence field, I've come to really appreciate the nuances and the complexities that define the work. The Gateway Center is a powerful collective of providers working together, and we've become a hub for some important collaborations that reach beyond the center's walls, two of which I'm looking forward to having highlighted here today. But all of our best efforts will not solve domestic violence, and while I'm deeply proud of the work that I will share about today, I humbly say we cannot fix this alone. For this presentation, I'm going to spend a few minutes highlighting the work of the Gateway Center because it's important in terms of the investment the city makes in this area. But I'm going to turn to my partners to share about two community-wide collaborations that are reaching survivors across agencies and entities and are both important examples of the power we have when we work together. You'll hear from hopefully two survivors today, one in person, and I hope that their words will inspire your ongoing commitment to survivors of domestic and sexual violence and their children. And finally, I'm going to give you a peek into a new project that I hope will be the beginning of our next community-wide success. I should also say that Sergeant Martin Padilla is scheduled to join us today. He's caught on it. 84. He's in touch with me on my phone, which is why this is sitting near me. I'm very hopeful that he will make it. I can change the order a little bit to give him a little bit more time. If not, I'm going to pitch hit for him in his absence. So excuse me if I seem slightly distracted while I look around for him. Okay, let's talk about the Gateway Center. I know that you're aware of the variety of services that we provide at the center, but I'd like to take a minute to highlight them and thank my partners. Most people come to the Gateway Center for what we think of as safety services. So they come for restraining orders, they come for safety planning and advocacy services. Those services are done by an amazing team of advocates that come from NAYA Family Center, Bradley Engels Healing Roots Center, the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization, Self Enhancement Inc., El Programa Hispano, and the YWCA of Greater Portland, and I thank them for helping ensure that some of the best advocates in the city come to work at the Gateway Center. We're also proud to house a variety of stability services, including therapeutic services for children and adults, three different types of legal services, access to criminal justice services, housing placement and subsidies, economic empowerment, access to OHP and food assistance. And the Gateway Center would not be the Gateway Center without Impact Northwest, LifeWorks Northwest, the Oregon Department of Human Services, Legal Aid Services of Oregon, the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center, Catholic Charities Immigration Legal Services, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, the Disability Awareness Resource Team, Portland Police, Volunteers of America Home Free. It's a village. We really are a village, and it takes that. I thank all those partners for the energy and spirit they bring to the work. To make the services easy to access, we're conveniently located on public transportation. We also have a drop-in child care. So I want to say some final thanks to VOA Home Free's and VOA's Relief Nursery for the child care we rely on, as well as Ride Connection and Lyft for transportation support, and the food bank and Starbucks for helping keep our participant kitchen full. People learn about the Gateway Center in a variety of ways. The biggest is a kind of broad category called service provider. I think what this indicates is that there's a fairly high level of consciousness of domestic violence in our community, but people lack the time or the expertise to know how to help, so they send them to the Gateway Center, and we're really happy to get their referrals. The second biggest category comes from community members. So family and friends trust the Gateway Center to help their loved ones when they're dealing with domestic violence. Since we've opened, between 20 and 25% of our referrals come from a law enforcement interaction. So we are able to enhance the public safety intervention. The Oregonian reported earlier this month that between January 1st and August 30th, they received 3,000 domestic violence calls. And in that same period of time, 494 individuals came into the Gateway Center saying they learned about our services from police. So it's a good partnership, and it's working. Boom, boom, boom. Just a few moments on demographics. I'm not going to read all of these numbers. About 17% of the folks who came last year were African-American, 13% were Latina, and another 11% identified as multiracial. Oh, I should say here, though, too, that about 10% of our visits to the center require services in a language other than English. And in this 12-month period, we provided services in more than 30 languages. So the age of our participants, the big bulk of folks we see are between 20 and 50 years old. But last year we saw 452 individuals who were over 50. We serve way more women-identified folks than male-identified folks, but we do help men when they seek our services if they are experiencing domestic violence. In terms of how busy we are very busy. We count both visits to the center as well as unique visitors to the center. So the visits you see there on the left and the unique visitors are on the right. How this breaks down into our day-to-day work, we average 36 adult survivors seeking services each day. That's an average. If you add the average number of children coming into the center and the people that come for support groups, it goes up to about 45. We don't count the support people that come in the doors with those folks, which we certainly let in, sisters, friends, other people, but we're very, very busy. These are the services that our first-time visitors indicate that they want in their check-in. These percentages won't add up to 100 because people can check that they want multiple things. So you can see that more than half of the people coming in the doors are interested in getting a restraining order. But a similar number, and some of the same people, say, I don't know what I want to do. I want to explore my options while I'm here. That's why we have that talented expert advocacy staff as our frontline staff, is to really help people think about what's available. A really important learning that's happened for us over the years at the Gateway Center is that the folks coming in don't always know about the services that are available in the community and don't have words to say them. And so it's really important that we have this space to talk about what the options are, what the criteria are, and how to access the services.
Can I ask, and you may have
sure.
this in a future slide, but
sure.
what percentage of your visitors mm-hmm. need some kind of emergency housing mm-hmm. as a that you learn about through the first contact?
I know about people's housing situations for the folks that sit down with the navigators. Our best number on that is about 17% of folks are looking for a housing change. So only a portion of those would say that they were home. I know that's not exactly your question. I'm
right.
getting that.
No, it's helpful.
A portion of those identify as homeless. Others are in a version of a shelter or with a family or friend, but it's not a stable situation. When you're talking about emergency and sort of for a safety reason, it's difficult, and I don't have a good number for you. Abby is going to be able to share how many times our community-wide across our domestic violence continuum we use, how many shelter beds we've used in our continuum, as well as how many motel vouchers we've used to get somebody safe. We do frequently put somebody in a motel that day, that night, from the Gateway Center, because that's the only safe option that we have. Okay. I'd be happy to get more specific and follow up with you after today.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for the question. Two more pieces of information before I turn it over to my partners. I thought it would be good to show the kind of broad investments that are made by the two arms of local government. For the city's part, it's me and my team of three that are amazing, by the way. Amanda Scott, Karina, if you're listening, I think you're the best. And the frontline advocacy staff comes out of the city investment, as well as immigration legal services and operating expenses. But Multnomah County makes very significant investments to the Gateway Center, too, including the use of an 11,000-square-foot building, our security officer, an adult therapist, and the victim advocate from the district attorney's office. Now, these investments are supported by other contributions from partners who maybe have staff in the building, but we don't pay to be there. So it's a great community-wide collaborative project. And this may be a video that will play, and it might not be a video. This is a video I had that was produced by Domestic Violence Safe Dialogues of a survivor named Audra Reed, who gave us permission to use it. She basically is talking about, in a context away from the Gateway Center, something not about the Gateway Center at all, that the Gateway Center made it possible for her to change her life, and that if she'd had access to such resources, she would have left 15 years earlier. But we have Tiffany here as a real person who will share her story shortly. I'm sorry that didn't work. These are the advisory council members, and the last specific slide to the Gateway Center before I turn it over. This is a group that only comes together quarterly now, but they are willing to wrestle with important struggles that we face in the domestic violence world, including one that Officer Padilla was going to talk about, and if he arrives, he will. If not, I will. For many, many years, restraining order respondents, the people that are restrained under a restraining order, were ordered not to possess guns. So there was a court order in place that said you may not possess guns. But there were no protocols or procedures to enforce that order. And this advisory council took that on, and we are now one of only five counties in Oregon that has protocols in place to help to ensure that restraining order respondents either surrender their guns or are held accountable for surrendering their guns. And I'm not going to have the exact numbers, but it's very exciting when you hear how many guns we got. I am going to then turn it over to Abby Gassama from NAYA Family Center. Abby has been part of a collaborative effort to improve our access to coordinated shelter and housing services across the DV continuum, and she's going to tell you more about that. Take it away, Abby.
Good morning.
Morning.
As Martha said, I'm Abby Gassama, and I work at the Native American Youth and Family Center. I've been there for about 7.5 years, and I've been working in the domestic and sexual violence field for 13. Thanks again, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners, for your proclamation and recognition, both of domestic and sexual violence as a social ill, but also of our continuum's connectedness and expertise in this area. So in 2014, we embarked on a system-wide process to coordinate access to both our shelter and our housing interventions. And the Gateway Center provided both the space to do this and the leadership in this effort. Martha was a very fearless leader for us for this long and difficult process. Fortunately, we already had housing-specific resources that were within the domestic violence continuum, which was amazing because that made it possible for us to have the power to make these decisions internally about how we were going to coordinate access. I mention this because in many jurisdictions, there aren't housing resources set aside specifically for domestic violence services, and in those places, they're having difficulties even getting to the table to talk about housing resources for domestic violence-specific set-asides. I'm really grateful for our leaders that came before us and resourced our system in this way. And I don't know, Mayor Wheeler, if you were a part of that previously, but if you were, thank you, because it really set us up to succeed. So the key question that we had to talk about when we were making this new coordinated access system was really what makes one survivor more vulnerable than another? And really, all the existing vulnerability indexes and assessments that we had available to us either didn't take domestic violence into account at all, or it was just one question on an assessment that really didn't dig into what an advocate would ask when we're talking about vulnerability for survivors. What makes a single adult vulnerable in the homeless system or a family vulnerable in the homeless family system is a really different kind of vulnerability than what we're talking about when we're talking about domestic violence survivors. It looks really different. So what we landed on was that none of these assessments worked and that we had to create our own. So prior to doing this work, we all really competed for scarce resources. So there's 14 agencies, and we were all kind of battling amongst ourselves to get these really small resources. And oftentimes what was happening was advocates that had been around the longest and had the best resources or the best connections with folks at other agencies were getting the best resources for their participants because they had those connections with other folks at other agencies that held those housing resources, which really played out in a difficult way, I think, especially for culturally specific organizations because we don't have shelters and we had fewer housing interventions at that time internally. And so I remember when I came on board in 2010, and I was working with participants, I really only had success getting my participants into one of our shelters. And the reason being, I had a connection with the folks at that shelter because we ran a support group in that shelter. And prior to coordinated access, I never had success getting any of my participants into either one of the other shelters because I didn't have a relationship with the folks that worked at those shelters. So this was really unfair to our participants and to our staff who were burning out quickly because they didn't feel like they could help people that they were working with. And so I'm really proud that we got to this point where we were able to create what we now call the Safety and Stabilization Assessment. This allows us to cooperate across agencies to serve our most vulnerable survivors with some of our most precious resources. The most precious of those, I would say, are our long-term housing resources, which are six-month and longer housing interventions that we provide. And for those subsidies, we all come together as a continuum. So we're no longer 14 agencies competing, but we are a team together that meets bi-monthly at what we call a resource coordination team meeting to bring folks that we're working with at all of our agencies and discuss who best fits this resource that we have available, and we can make a collaborative decision together about that. Yeah. So, as Martha talked about earlier, and as you can see on this slide, we help a lot of people within our system. And the people who we help truly benefit from our expertise. They benefit from our expertise in being able to contextualize rental and employment histories to landlords based on domestic violence, our expertise in the impact of trauma on the brain, our expertise in the prevalence of victim blaming and how we can interrupt that even when the survivors that we're working with often blame themselves for what's happened. And having these resources allows survivors to benefit from our expertise and our specialty over time. I don't know if I really need to read the numbers. They're up there, but you can see that we sheltered 392 individuals in this last fiscal year, and that is in our domestic violence shelters specifically. On top of that, we motel vouchered 931 individuals, and those are folks that may have eventually been able to find safety in another way outside of seeking shelter. We often call those diversion resources, so making a plan to live with friends and family. These are folks that we may have eventually been able to help with a rental resource and get them into a new place. These are also folks that sometimes we relocate to different communities for safety reasons. And then we provided 692 individuals with what we call agency-based decisions, which are rent assistance, moving assistance, 6 months or less, and then 288 individuals received 6 months or longer housing subsidies through our new continuum. So it's an honor to be a part of Portland's domestic violence continuum. I'm proud to tell you that we are leading the nation when it comes to coordinated access to shelter and housing for domestic violence survivors, and your investments in our services helped us to get there. So Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Actually, several. On the grant agreement to the YWCA, as you pointed out, Mr. Morris, you have a lot of partners.
Yes.
So how was the YWCA selected as the one to do this particular project?
They were, and I'm going to circle back to this also at the end.
Okay.
But I can tell you, to tell you just a lot about this little elder abuse expansion. They were, they're already a host to an Encore Fellow. So they know what administratively it takes, and we're willing to take the money and then have that person as an employee in their agency.
Okay, I thought you were done with your presentation, so I'll wait until the end. That's
thank
fine.
You. I will welcome you. Thank you. So I am pleased that Sergeant Martin Padilla of the Portland Police Bureau's Family Services Division is here to join us with more details about our gun dispossession program. I consider Sergeant Padilla a real ally in this work, and I'm grateful that he could be with us today.
I'd like to thank Martha and the efforts.
Move the microphone up, please.
Martha and the efforts of the Gateway Center, who we've at the Police Bureau have found to be an invaluable resource with our domestic violence survivors that come to us, to include their services for helping with obtaining restraining orders and just providing a safe place for them to report their DV-related crimes, as their office is right across the parking lot from ours. And just to give you a little context, the Police Bureau responds to about 11,000 domestic disturbances a year. My unit, the Family Services Division, Domestic Violence Reduction Unit, is only able to assign about 8 to 10% of those cases for follow-up. And our criteria for those assignments weigh lethality, the severity of the offense, presence of children, the history of the offender, and the likelihood of recidivism. For many years, however, we've had an absence in one type of domestic violence prevention that was not actively pursued, and that type was the dispossession of firearms from individuals prohibited from possessing them due to court order as mandated by the Family Abuse Prevention Act, or FAPA, which was passed in the 80s, specifically as what we know to be restraining orders. In 2014, the violation of restraining order gun dispossession program was developed in collaboration with the Police Bureau, Multnomah County DA's office, the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. And this program was conceived out of recognition of the alarming data that showed that one-third of all women in the U.S. were murdered by current or former intimate partners. Domestic violence assaults involving a firearm were 12 times more likely to result in death, and 52% of female homicides were committed with firearms. That's as of data that was published in 2014. So the program's purpose was to establish a procedure for enforcement action against those respondents who did not comply with the FAPA order or restraining order, with an emphasis on those who do not comply with the firearms prohibition. Simply put, the program's intent is domestic violence homicide prevention. So we accomplish this by a review and triage of all FAPA order violations, all FAPA orders served in Multnomah County in which the respondent failed to notify the court of a firearm surrender. Additionally, all other domestic violence incidents involving reported FAPA violations in the city of Portland as well as Multnomah County are reviewed, along with those referrals from some of our community partners like Gateway Center. Upon assignment by the domestic violence sergeant, usually me, or my partner, investigators will follow up with the victims or survivors and suspects, identify those cases that we find sufficient probable cause to proceed with an arrest or direct present to the DA's office, and or coordinate with parole and probation. In July of 2015, we actually implemented this. It was a part-time assignment for the FAPA order violations. We implemented it full-time to include one sergeant with the Police Bureau, two Police Bureau officers, and one county deputy. Since that, from July 2015, over the next 18 months till the end of 2016, the team reviewed and closed 362 dispossession or firearm dispossession cases, removing 110 firearms from individuals. The team reviewed and closed another 168 FAPA order violations, arresting 52 offenders, and we're referring another 135 cases for direct present to the DA's office for prosecution consideration. Additionally, in many of those cases in which survivors did not want to pursue charges, the investigators worked closely with advocates from both the Gateway Center or those embedded in our division to support the survivors both during and after the investigations. It just doesn't include criminal investigations. We'll try and support them in whatever needs they have. And I'd just like to thank personally, among all the community partners, Commissioner Salzman for his support in getting this program started, as well as DA Underhill.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yes.
So some of the people you have to go after and physically take their firearms, how do others say, well, I've already turned it in? Is there a place that they have to put into their all their firearms, and how do we know that they don't have more?
A lot of, as far as them turning it in, they're required to complete an affidavit. If when the FAP order is completed and signed by the judge, they're required to complete an affidavit if it's been told to the court by the petitioner. If they have firearms, they have to say where they've disposed of those firearms. With Oregon state law, when they transfer those firearms, if it's to another individual, that other individual has to complete a background check, and it's easily followed up with OSP. If otherwise, they have to provide a receipt from a law enforcement agency where they've submitted the firearms for safekeeping.
So we don't just trust the affidavit?
No. And they can lie on the affidavit,
yes.
But when we've submitted 18 cases in which we have believed they've been lying to us.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sergeant, our final presenter today is a very courageous, determined, tenacious woman that I admire from the top of my head to the bottom of my shoes, and I'm so pleased she would join us today. Tiffany.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Eagleton, and I identify as a domestic violence and sexual violence survivor. And that was a little emotional, so I'm going to try to get through this and be time conscious. So just to begin, my story started where my first escape from my first husband was at 22 years old. And it was in a small, I'm 34 now, it was in a small town, a small community, and they did not have the types of resources that we have here with Gateway or the education. And so hindsight, had I maybe got that at 22 years old, maybe I wouldn't have had to go through the next 9+ years. So I'm very grateful to Gateway. I went to Gateway originally in 2013, and I wanted to just list the services to give you an idea of that. As soon as a survivor or a victim of domestic violence, when they leave and go get a restraining order, it doesn't just end there. It takes a long time, a lot of community support, a lot of services to get healthy, to break the cycle if they get to that point. And I want to say my case was a high lethality case, and I am grateful to be alive today and to have also walked through everything that I have walked through to be sitting here today. So I originally went to Gateway. I worked with the administrative staff there, the navigators. I did restraining orders, multiple. I used their court services, the video services there, which was amazing for me because my abuser was at the courthouse more than one time. So I would have had to be in an unsafe. I probably wouldn't have made it into court. Gateway Child Care, I have 3 children, the VOA Home Free, several of their services, the DHS, the DV unit, the Oregon Crime Victim Law Center, DVRU, the police officers that are with the domestic violence, regular police, the divert team, district attorney's office, legal aid, the DV shelter, Raphael House, the RCT. I was in that program, the first participant. And that's for long-term domestic violence housing. Also, I used the vouchers for hotels. I also did outpatient drug and alcohol treatment. That is also part of my story, as I have found many others who have tried to find a coping mechanism with that. And I almost have 3 years clean, so I'm very proud of that. Counseling for my three children, individual counseling, trauma counseling, the TRIM program, EMDR, parenting counseling, DV support groups, DV spiritual support groups, parenting support groups, domestic violence awareness class, and other education, anything that I could get to try to help me to stop my cycle of getting into unhealthy relationships, economic empowerment, and other financial assistance with that. So I would like to, you know, this affected all of the entities of my life, emotional, physical, financial, mental, and sexual. So it's been a long journey, and I would just like to say that with all of the support that I have in my life, the domestic violence part of it, my advocates were the most powerful for me to be able to actually live a life today. And the expertise that they have, how they walked beside me, not drug me or tried to control me or told me what to do, because that's what I came out of. And so I was empowered by them. They were like my cheerleaders and really helped me. And it was a beautiful relationship, is a beautiful relationship. And very unique. I feel very empowered today. I live a life of service, both in my recovery of drugs and alcohol, but also in my domestic violence side. And I get to give back to other survivors, other families. And it's hard for me still to talk about myself this way, but that's what I'm here for today, is to represent what all of these services can do and what's possible and the reason we do it. And the main thing is that I cannot believe I'm alive today and able to sit here and do this and to be healthy and thriving. And Gateway was really the start of that for me. And they have wrapped their arms around me. And it was a very scary process. So I, of course, have so many more things to say, but I want to be time conscious and respect that. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here so much.
So can I just ask a follow-up question? I mean, that was amazing. Thank you so much. And I think it's amazing that you're able to give back and continue to be thinking about what happened to you and your efforts to save others. What's are there any consequences for your abuser?
I do believe that we have a lot of work to do in the systems, in the court systems, and more domestic violence awareness for everyone. I think you guys are doing a great job. But there is definitely room for improvement. So
that's all. You don't need to go further. That was kind of a personal question.
Yeah, there was some prosecution for he did violate the restraining order, and the DVRU team was able to prosecute him. But he just received like 4 hours in jail, and yeah, so I mean, it's still an ongoing process for me because I have children.
Yeah.
With both of my ex-husbands who were abusers. And So parts of it are sad stories, but I'm getting through it, and I get to take the experience that I've had and the challenges that I've had to walk through, and I'm able to have that knowledge and help others to hopefully not go through the same thing.
I so appreciate that. As you were listing all the services you received, I'm very glad that the services were available, and then I'm thinking what harm to you and to our whole community can come from one or two people who are abusive. And it says to me, kind of harking back to the prosecuting when people don't turn their guns in,
there needs
to be more consequences, because violence, as was noted, results in a lot of murders of people. And sometimes it's dealt with by 4 hours in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for sharing that too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I really appreciate those comments. I think as a community, we're trying to work on accountability all the time, and it is difficult. We're still up here. There's still a lot of work to do. I appreciated the nuance of your question of what if the person who turns in a gun has another gun? We don't know.
Yeah.
So... But 110 guns are not in those people's hands, and that's true. So it's celebrating and continuing to try.
And once they're on a restraining order, do they have to have another background check? Can they go out and buy another one?
They should not be able to buy a gun in Oregon if there is a restraining order in place.
If they've been convicted of a domestic violence crime or they have a restraining order on file, it's unlawful for them to purchase a firearm, and that should show up in a background check.
And I was just reading a book. We don't have a law in Oregon that says if the background checkers don't get back to them in 3 days, they get to buy the gun anyway.
There is no time.
I'm talking to the microphone because otherwise the captionist can't.
There's no time limit for the background check. It's just whenever they complete the background check.
Typically, so they can't get one without one.
They cannot get one if they have any conviction of domestic violence, be it misdemeanor or felony, or they have a restraining order currently on file.
I'm partway through reading through Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened, and she talks about gun laws in some states where if they don't get back to them in 3 days, they get to buy the gun anyway.
We don't have that in Oregon.
Thank you. I'm glad.
A study was just published that shows 57% of mass shootings in the United States have a domestic violence connection.
Wow.
Yeah. Before we part today, I did want to talk about this effort that you can help support me with this amendment to the YWCA grant that we're talking about. There's two different types. There's actually several different types of restraining orders, but the ones most frequently sought at the Gateway Center, what we call the FAPA, which requires a relationship with the other person. It's a marriage. It's a child together. It's a boyfriend-girlfriend situation. But there's people that suffer abuse and people in their lives that don't have that FAPA relationship that might qualify for what we call an EPDAPA, or the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disability Abuse Prevention Act. When an elderly or disabled person comes to the Gateway Center seeking an EPDAPA and they don't have an intimate partner violence situation going on, we do not have the space or the staff or the capacity to help them currently with that protection order. And I'm really concerned about this population. I'm concerned about these people coming saying, I need the court's protection. And I'm wondering what else they would need if we were able to serve them. And I think I figured out a way in the fairly short term that we could do a study around these people and increase my staff capacity enough to let them come in the door. And that is through a partnership with Social Venture Partners Encore Fellows Program. The Encore Fellows Program brings on retired high-level professionals to do 1,000-hour-long projects in community sort of social justice-based endeavors. And I would like to bring an Encore Fellow into the Gateway Center to do EPDAPAs with people seeking them and to study their needs so that I could go to policymakers at the end of maybe a 9-month period of time to say, Portland could really benefit, Multnomah County could really benefit from a center that surrounded people seeking UPDAPAs with services similar to the kind of robust and holistic services we currently do for IPV at the Gateway Center. Because I'm City of Portland, I can't employ an Encore Fellow directly, but one of my partners has is willing to act as a host for an Encore Fellow, and without giving them any direction. So the direction to the Encore Fellow would be in partnership with the Gateway Center. The idea is that, again, they would do some UPDAPAs in the building. They would go and talk to all of the elder abuse service providers currently in the continuum, Elders in Action, Aging and Disability Services. There's a ton, I don't know them, like I know my folks. And through interviews with stakeholders, and again, interviews with the actual people seeking services, come up with a vision for maybe what an elder and disabled person's Gateway Center might look like, or what the Gateway Center could expand into given space, staff capacity, et cetera. So that's what I'm asking for help with today. It's very strategic and targeted because, again, we're full to the gills at the Gateway Center. We regularly reach capacity in terms of who we can serve. But through this way, I think I can stop sending these folks downtown.
Good. Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. And so why was the YWCA chosen out of all of the partners that you have?
They are the ones that currently host an Encore Fellow, and so we're willing to sort of take it on. They're close to us. Susan Stoltenberg is on the advisory council of the Gateway Center and is a person who's sort of deeply interested in aging and issues for the aging population, and it just seemed a natural partnership.
And I noticed that the initial relationship with YWCA was in 2010 when Commissioner Saltzman was setting things up, and
yes,
many amendments over time.
Yes,
are we going to be in the place where we can say these are going to be our permanent partners, or at some point do you have to go out for another request for interest?
I appreciate you asking the question. The amendment to the Gateway Center original relationship was as a navigator agency. They, in between times, closed down their shelter and opened the Yolanda Project, which is a housing diversion project that is housed at the Gateway Center. That housing project has been an incredible asset to us, and when the housing state of emergency was declared in 2015, the YWCA, with no additional staff, was willing to take on eviction prevention investments that would go straight into making sure that people didn't lose their housing. They were uniquely positioned to do that as the housing provider already at the Gateway Center, and so two of those amendments are about housing, and the others are just about increasing the terms of the navigator services. But they were a natural partner with Susan Stoltenberg at the head, already hosting an Encore Fellow to do this partnership. I think your question about navigators, though, is right, that there will be a time. These current ones expire in June 30, 2019, and I think at that time I'd like to go to the wider provider community again and say, do we have everybody who would like to be a navigator at the Gateway Center with us? Currently, SEI is actually not on contract with us. They provide navigation services through a grant. So I already have a partner trying to come in. So I do think it's time to go community-wide again the next time.
Thank you very much.
So I want to thank you all and ask you to stay here for a second. Before we go to testimony or take votes, I'd like to ask Mayor Wheeler to read the proclamation.
Great. Thank you.
I don't want to forget that.
Yeah, it's my honor to read a proclamation on behalf of the Portland City Council in support of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Whereas domestic violence is a crime that touches the lives of Portlanders of all ages, leaving a devastating impact on women, men, and children of every background and circumstance. And whereas domestic violence accounts for a significant number of assaults committed in the city of Portland, and nearly one-third of Oregon women reported experiencing domestic violence, stalking, sexual, or physical assault. And whereas Portland has demonstrated a long-standing commitment to addressing this problem in partnership with Multnomah County, the District Attorney's Office, and community service providers. And whereas 8 years ago, the City of Portland, in cooperation with Multnomah County, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, the Multnomah County Circuit Court, and community partners, opened the area's first one-stop center for domestic violence victims, the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services. And whereas the Gateway Center's satellite courtroom files over 50% of all restraining orders in Multnomah County and has upwards of 11,000 visits per year, 3,824 of which are unduplicated. Whereas children who are exposed to domestic violence experience higher levels of adult depression and trauma symptoms and are much more likely than children not exposed to violence to use and or tolerate violence in their adult relationships. And whereas the city promotes the closing of the equity gap for Indigenous peoples through policies, practices, and investments that reflect the experiences of Indigenous peoples, ensuring greater access and opportunity, and honoring our nation's Indigenous history and contributions. And whereas the City of Portland recognizes and thanks all the organizations and groups that are committed to address, prevent, and heal from domestic violence, often working directly with survivors to ensure that they have access to employment opportunities, housing, legal resources, and other services. Now, therefore, I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 2017 to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this month by gaining awareness of this issue and supporting organizations that work to address, prevent, and help those affected heal from domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to thank you all for the great work you do.
Spin the rules.
Spin the rules, yeah. I just want to thank, first of all, Martha Strawn Morris for doing an outstanding job of leading the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services. You're doing a great job. Sergeant Padilla, for all the great work you're doing. Abby, for your continued work at NEA. And Tiffany, thank you for sharing your story today. It really helps to have the human touch. It helps us.
Very good. Thank you. Public testimony on the ordinance?
I have three people signed up.
Take a seat.
They're Star Stoffer, Joe Walsh, and Craig Rogers.
Coming up, 3 minutes. Name for the record, please.
Good morning, Star Stoffer. Quite frankly, I don't think $30,000 is enough. I am also a survivor of domestic violence. My own father tried to kill me 3 times, and I survived a brutal beating and rape where I was almost murdered in my own home at 15. Unfortunately, there are a couple questions/criticisms I have for the program. When I was young, I was also sexually assaulted by a police officer. There are many instances where there are women like me who are abused by police officers, or for one reason or another, maybe their legal status or fear of being placed back with their abuser, like I was with my father, where they can't go to the police. They can't file a restraining order. It's not an option. There needs to be more services in place for these women, because I know from experience that when you're unwilling to file a restraining order, the justice system just basically wants nothing to do with you if you're not willing to cooperate with the police. If you are an illegal immigrant, the chances that you're going to want to talk to the police or take this to court are another issue. They're very low because you're more terrified of being deported and further trauma being put against you and your children by reporting this abuse. I have known mothers who were deported after reporting their abuse to police, and their children taken away and placed in foster care. There are not enough services for women that are vulnerable to police violence or women that are vulnerable to their status being in question as far as the legality of them being here. There needs to be more services for that. It's disappointing. And it's not a criticism against their work or what they do. There's not enough people like this program. But it's disappointing that there's only a person basically available one day a week for people with immigration status that is questionable by the government. There needs to be more. There needs to be a lot more services. There needs to be emergency housing and secret housing placement for people who are suffering or potentially suffering violence at the hands of police officers. There was a woman several years ago killed by her sheriff partner in Clackamas County in the middle of a restaurant with his police issue weapon. So this is, I'm going to go about 30 seconds over. This is a very serious issue for me. I was not able to seek justice against my rapist because 2 months before it happened, I was sexually assaulted by a Portland police officer during a search. So that wasn't an option for me. And unfortunately, there's a lot of women that's not an option for. There needs to be services in place and money in place for women who cannot go that route to get them help, counseling, services, and some form of justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record again, my name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. One of the things that I always find, and let me make this up front very clear, we fully support this, that we think it's a good program. We think you should fund it. However, we don't think the $30,000 is enough. One of the things that I find all the time, and I've been doing this with you guys for 10 years, is we fund the minimum. Why don't we fund the maximum? Not the middle. The maximum. They just asked you for more to do another program that perked out my ears because they're not to do it the elderly. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in you funding that. I'm interested in you asking them, okay, what is it that you need to feel successful? Not what you need to get by. That's what we do. We take, well, you know, we have all of these things that we have to spend money on, and we have to be careful with the money. My God, to save a life. I mean, I would defend that. Wouldn't you defend that? You'd go up to 20%, man. You would. You'd zoom. If you stood there and said, I am going to give you not $30,000, I'm giving you $60,000. You know, when I go out on the street and Street Roots comes up and they say, would you buy a paper? I don't give them a dollar. I give them $5. I say, here, let me have the paper and go get a cup of coffee. You know why I do that? Because it makes them feel good. Makes the vendors feel like someone pays attention to them. When somebody asks you for something, double it. If you can. Sometimes you can't. But if you can, they're asking for 30 grand. Give them 60. And say, do that other program. That sounds pretty good. You would be heroes. And then brag about that, Mayor, in an open press conference, not a closed one. And you would be heroes. You know, we come here and we pound you all the time. But believe it or not, I look for things that I can compliment you on. This is one. Go a little bit further, Amanda. Come on. You're shaking your head that you do it. Do it a little bit more. A little bit more. $30,000 is nothing in this budget. Save a life. Save a life. I grew up in domestic violence, too. I was an Irish Catholic family in Brooklyn, New York in the 40s. A lot of knockdown, drag-out fights in my family. Give them the $60,000. And then read the proclamation, Mayor, with a smile. Now you can just say, eh, we did okay. do better.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Craig Rogers. I live across from East Portland Community Center, one of my favorite places, and Floyd Light Middle School and East Portland Police Precinct. It's also been called a gamer trail, as the police have informed me. And there's a deeply wooded hillside there. And with this hillside, the homeless have gravitated to it because it's a bad actor's dream. I've seen numerous examples of domestic violence take place on this hillside. I've seen a woman take an elbow to the side of the head and go flying through the air, and I yell across the field, I'm calling the police, and then the two of them get in the vehicle and drive off, the RV. I saw a woman walking past my house and this yelling going on, and I open up the door, and the guy's tracked her down, and he catches up to her, and he's threatening to dump her shopping cart with all her belongings in it. Now, I have called the city numerous times. If they even ask me, does this involve the homeless, and they go to non-emergency, and I hang for 20 minutes. You know, it just doesn't work. That's why my area